Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Senate Bill 54 is a measure that's meant to rework the state's campaign finance requirements. The bill narrowly passed through committee and was also a close vote in the Senate. Now the bill moves to the House, where many are saying it's liable to be further amended. Joining me to talk about Senate Bill 54, SDPB's political reporter Lee Strubinger from Rapid City. Hey, Lee.
Hey, how's it going?
So tell us what's going on with Senate Bill 54. Is this a response to our ongoing conversation about IM-22 and its passage?
Well, yeah, kind of. So Senate Bill 54 is the result of a summer study session on campaign finance in South Dakota, as well as IM-22. Recall over the summer, Secretary of State Chantel Krebs spearheaded a task force about campaign finance reform and brought a bill to the legislature to clarify some state statute on limits while also hoping to increase disclosure requirements. Krebs said it kind of seeks to further clarify who can give what to whom, how much, and how to report it. And what IM-22 did was it sort of kickstarted the conversation about campaign finance limits. And IM-22 reduced a lot of those contribution limits or amounts that candidates could accept.
All right, so how does IM-22 fit into all of this?
Well, since lawmakers repealed IM-22, they're now looking to replace state law with figures and limits of their own. IM-22 lowered the dollar amount people and organizations and parties can contribute to a candidate for political office, as well as political organizations. What Secretary of State Krebs' task force proposal did was it increased some caps on political money. For example, if someone gave money to a political party, the original bill increased that amount from $5,000 to about $10,000 a year. Whereas IM-22 kept that limit right at around $5,000. So with Senate Bill 54, there have been several amendments to it. And during the course of this bill's hearing in the Senate State Affairs Committee, it was amended 9 times.
So what was it before this Senate Bill 54 and before IM-22? Do we know? Then IM-22 said, let's keep that limit right at about $5,000. Senate Bill 54 is looking at $10,000. Do we know what it was before any of this started coming or not?
Right. That depends on who's giving money to what entity.
Okay.
And how much.
There are, right. Yeah. We'll keep it clean to what we know right now. So tell me,
sure, right,
nine
right.
amendments, and what were some of those amendments that came up?
A lot of the amendments, there were some increases in amounts as to what entities like individuals, political action committees, and even out-of-state groups, what they can donate to whom. But there was also an amendment added that prohibits lawmakers from cashing out their fundraised money for personal use. It instead requires them, once they're done politically, to donate that money to a nonprofit or to another candidate or political entity. Now, during the course of testimony and debate on this bill, Democrats attempted to hoghouse the measure, which is severely amend the language in the bill with what provisions IM-22 had. And here's Democrat Senator Billy Sutton, who floated that amendment.
They had a real opportunity in that they could have taken the language from IM-22 and put it into Senate Bill 54 and done exactly what the will and intent of the voters was as it related to campaign finance reform. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. We gave them a lot of opportunities to do so. We brought a hoghouse amendment not only in committee but on the Senate floor to adopt the language as it related to campaign finance reform from IM-22.
Sutton says he really wanted the IM-22 campaign finance limit discussion both in the committees and on the floor, but his amendment got tabled both times, which are non-debatable motions. Mm-hmm. Now, Republican Senator Bob Ewing chairs the Senate State Affairs Committee that looked at this bill, and during the last hearing on Senate Bill 54, he said there had been plenty of discussion and that more bills related to campaign finance will eventually come up.
We've had extensive discussion amongst ourselves on the floor in caucus and committees to try to come up with some language for replacement for IM-22. And it's been a difficult chore, I think. We tried to put something together here to get it on down to the floor. We've got other legislation coming from the House side, so I'm quite sure that this is not going to be the end result or the form that we see, but it is a start. It's a good place to start the discussion.
So, Lee, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to the In the Moment. We're talking with SDPB political reporter Lee Strubinger, and our conversation today is about Senate Bill 54. And, Lee, this all ties into what we talked about last week with this legislative task forces.
Right, exactly. There are several differing opinions, even among just Republicans, on how to handle this bill. Republican Senator and Majority Leader Blake Hurd voted against Senate Bill 54. He says that cleaning up state statute as it relates to campaign finance is an arduous task that needs more time to be looked over, which would likely be a task force.
To assume that we were able to effectively do that through the course of 2 to 3 weeks, to me, I think, is somewhat arrogant and perhaps should give us all reason to pause and show that we have shown that we are addressing it and interested in continuing to move forward with something meaningful, but at this point, it's going to be difficult for me to say that the product that we've created here is the best that we can do.
And there are other senators like Senator Jim Bolin, who says that lawmakers shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, meaning that, you know, no legislation is going to be perfect, and that he trusts in the process and the changes that the House may make. And if it comes back to the Senate, there has to be an agreement there. So this bill is definitely not in its final form.
So, Lee, when he says 2 to 3 weeks to take on this massive undertaking, is that accurate, or is that sort of a misrepresentation of how much time they've had in the session?
Well, I mean, there are more than just 2 to 3 weeks in the session. But,
right.
I mean, when it really comes down to it, lawmakers have to, you know, first and foremost, balance the budget. And, you know, they've dealt with several different issues this legislative session. And to really focus in on just the campaign finance limits and requirements and all that sort of thing, you know, I think they really want more time to look at it, actually.
Right, I understand. So, well, how about Secretary of State Chantel Krebs? What does she have to say about this Senate Bill 54?
Well, she says the bill is still a work in progress and that the final product is far from being delivered. But as far as the campaign finance limits goes, she says her office was looking more at reporting requirements and not necessarily specific limits.
I don't think you're going to see 54 in its final form until, you know, the final days. So I know that there's still there's not a consensus yet. Again, essentially, we're out of that process, though. We provided the working document in the original form of the bill. Was more disclosure, more reporting to be reported. I wanted more reporting to be more often for statewide candidates, and I wanted more information from those that were donating. That was essentially the crux of the bill. And beyond that, all the limitations and the dollar amounts and contribution changes that they've made, like, again, we had current statute already in place. That's been the legislature touching that. And I don't think it's going to be in its final form the way I'm hearing.
And it's important to note that, you know, the bill passed the Senate on legislative crossover day last week by 19-16 in favor of passing. And there wasn't really a whole lot of debate on the bill when it was on the Senate floor. So now Senate Bill 54 is scheduled to be heard in the House State Affairs Committee. And as of right now, it doesn't have a date set for that hearing, but it will be heard.
Lee, how much time do they have left? We're getting to the end of this session.
Right, yeah. I think next week is
next
the last week.
Wrapped up. Anything else on the docket for today that you're following?
Getting ready to go.
Yeah. That's a big question.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm getting ready to go out to Pierre again. So.
All right. Lee Strubinger is SDPB's political reporter on his way to Pierre. Thanks for the good work.
Hey, thank you.
Scientists in Antarctica are moving research camps because of a 100-mile-long crack moving across the world's southernmost continent. They're also concerned that a substantial portion of Antarctica could fall into the sea. But not everything in the land of ice is threatened. In fact, the world's largest marine protected area was recently created in the Ross Sea. SDPB's Jim Kent spoke with a scientist from Hot Springs who plays a key role in bringing 24 nations and the European Union into agreement to protect Antarctic marine life. Ben Sharp spent 5 years convincing these countries to protect what's, in effect, the largest national park in the ocean. He did it using the common language of scientific principles.
My name is Ben Sharp. I'm a scientist for the New Zealand government.
Ben Sharp was born and raised in the southern Black Hills town of Hot Springs. After attending university in the United Kingdom and pursuing his PhD in Australia, he ended up in New Zealand as a marine ecologist. Sharp worked for the New Zealand government as part of the Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources. The international group was created in 1982 with the objective of conserving Antarctic marine life. Sharp says members of the convention began talking about a protected Antarctic marine area as early as 2005.
It's a consensus forum. You need all 25 members have to agree. One person says no, and nothing happens. You come back the next year and you try again. And there's, you know, poor countries and rich countries and Western countries and Eastern countries. There's countries that fish and countries that don't. So to get agreement on something as big as that, it almost seems like an impossible task. But it's a wonderfully designed convention in that the scientific basis for decision-making is that you have to have a balance between conservation and utilization, but the conservation requirement is very stringent. It's the most conservation-minded ocean management forum out there.
The other requirement for the protected area was that all decisions had to be made on the basis of science. Diplomats and politicians could agree or disagree, but the ultimate proposal came through the scientific committee, which is an independent body. The first scientific design proposal was presented in 2011, and that's when the diplomats and politicians became involved.
Of course. I mean, nothing happens until they get involved. I mean, obviously, it's a declaration of what can and cannot happen on the high seas, which has all kinds of implications for international precedent and sovereignty issues and lots of things that are very political. I mean, the Antarctic Treaty is the basis for it was all the countries set aside any ideas of territorial claims in Antarctica for the purposes of the treaty. You know, basically all the countries pretend that the sovereignty claims don't exist, but the sovereignty claims are still sort of there on hold in the background, which makes everything you do intensely political. So nothing was going to happen until it got to the stage of getting that the political process in place.
New Zealand led the process of designing and proposing what ended up being the world's largest marine protected area. Called the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area, it covers some 600,000 square miles of the Southern Ocean and is safeguarded from commercial fishing for 35 years.
It was about 5 years of my life where that was the main part of my job that I was doing, you know, convincing 25 member countries to protect what's now the largest, effectively a national park, but in the ocean. As part of scientific justification behind the design of the marine protected area was a part of it was to protect areas where top predator populations rely upon the same resources that people are also catching.
As an example, Sharp referenced the Antarctic toothfish, which is sold as Chilean sea bass in restaurants, but it's also a critical part of the diet for killer whales.
And so this was the most persuasive argument that we made in the scientific justification for the protected area. But in the course of doing that, a lot of the other countries, you know, and legitimately, it's not a criticism, said, you know, this is all based on, you know, logic and first principles, but where is your actual evidence? They said, do you have a killer whale program? And well, no, we don't. And I anticipated this. So in the course of designing this, I was also advocating for we needed to start studying the things that we were using to justify it so that we would have real science behind it. And the killer whale program, through the efforts of myself and a lot of other people, ended up getting started.
Sharp notes that he loves to learn about people.
You know, the value systems of the people sitting around the table are incredibly different. You know, the Japanese and the Koreans and the Russians and the Norwegians all see the world differently. And instead of trying to bang the table and convince them that our value system was superior and therefore they should do what we said, we said, no, we've agreed to scientific principles and this is the one language we all have in common and the one thing we've already agreed to.
Sharp says by staying away from politics, the participants can focus on science and establish the protected area. He says it was possible with a neutral country like New Zealand at the helm. Ben Sharp says the best lesson from the five-year process was learning that scientists should be allowed to lead the discussion. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jim Kent.
Earlier today, USA Today reported that Antarctica has a new record high temperature of 63.5 degrees. Welcome to In the Moment, and welcome to March, celebrated as Women's History Month. We decided to look back at our conversation with one of today's best-selling authors, Ayelet Waldman, to launch the month of March. She's the author of five novels, as well as the essay collection Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. Author Ayelet Waldman joined us in January to talk about her new book, A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life. The book is about therapeutic microdoses of LSD to treat mental health issues. Let's start with the word microdosing, because when I type it into my introduction, I had the same problem that you did. It's not, you have to teach your spell check to recognize it as a word. So, let's start there. What exactly is microdosing?
So microdosing is taking a small quantity of a drug or a chemical, a quantity so small that it has no perceptual effects. It doesn't make you trip or anything, but it's large enough that it has a measurable cellular response. So in the case of LSD, I've never taken an acid trip, but people who have, they might take 100 to 200 micrograms. A microdose of LSD specifically is 10 micrograms.
How did you find out about it and finally start thinking that it was something that you wanted to give a shot?
Well, I think it's most important to understand where I was when I considered this experiment. I was in a really bad place. I had been treated for my mental illness, my mood disorder, for a long time, and treated very effectively. I am the kind of person who takes her medicine, and you know, I do what the doctor tells me, but the medications had stopped working. There were a lot. I had tried many different ones, and they simply weren't working. And then I started reading about this phenomenon of microdosing, and I started reading about the research that was going on at UCLA, at Johns Hopkins, at NYU, and Imperial College London on the effects of psychedelic drugs in eliminating the depression and anxiety that people with terminal cancer were feeling at the end of their lives. They were, you know, the fear and anxiety about dying. And I thought to myself, well, if a large dose of LSD or psilocybin or another psychedelic can make someone who's dying feel less afraid and less depressed, maybe a very tiny dose of LSD can make someone like me, who's so unhappy, feel a little better.
Mm. The book itself is really smart and funny, as all of your work is, also incredibly well-researched and insightful. Let's talk about who you shared this information early on with. Was it just your husband that you wanted to include?
You know, I have four kids, and I didn't want to say to them, hey, kids, guess what mommy's doing? She's taking acid. So I told my husband. And my husband, unlike me, had experience in college taking LSD, so he wasn't particularly worried about it. I was worried about it. I had to do a lot of research before I felt comfortable trying this. What I told my kids was that I was trying a new medicine, which they had experienced before. You know, when you have a mental illness or when you have depression, you often try different medications. Your doctor, things will work for a while, and then they'll stop, and the doctor will change things up. And so they were used to that. And I asked them to, you know, pay attention. You know, what was it like for them when I tried this new medication? Was I better? Was I worse? And what they noticed was pretty amazing. I mean, the thing that kind of broke my heart the most was when one of my sons said, you know, you've just been so much fun this past month. You've been so playful and fun to be around. You don't seem to get upset or as angry as you used to. It's really been amazing. And that definitely made a huge difference to me. And it also kind of broke my heart because, you know, what does that mean about what I was like before?
Mm. Or will be afterwards. Did you worry about that?
Yes, I do worry about that.
So if it works, yeah.
I needed to save my own life. I was suicidal. I was Googling the effects of maternal suicide on children, and you know, spoiler alert, they're not good. And I wanted to feel better, and I was willing to break the law to feel better for a month. But I wasn't willing to break the law forever. There are lots of people who microdose, and they don't stop. And in a perfect world, this is a medication that works for me. I would continue taking it. But what I decided to do was to stop taking it once I felt better, and then to start advocating for a more rational approach to drug policy, an approach that says, let's study these medications. Let's figure out if they can help. And if they can help, let's medicalize them. Let's have an approach to the drug war that doesn't just make, you know, the cartel, the violent criminals of the cartels in South and Central America wealthy. Let's have an approach to drugs that helps people and decreases the chances of harm, decreases the chances of opioid addiction, and increases the chances of benefit.
And how much of your research and stuff was really tied into with your former role as an attorney? How much did that help and inform this book and this process?
Well, you know, I think lawyers are trained to be skeptical. Right. And I was an attorney who was also a law professor. I had taught a seminar at UC Berkeley called The Legal and Social Implications of the War on Drugs. So I knew a lot about drugs, and I knew a lot about drug policy. So I knew where to research to reassure myself that this drug was safe, that the myths around LSD were in fact just myths, that there's never been an LSD overdose, which you can't say about Tylenol. Hundreds of people die every year from taking Tylenol overdoses. That the phenomenon of LSD psychosis is overstated and more myth than fact. So the fact that I had such a background in drug policy allowed me to have access to the research materials that reassured me that I was doing something that wasn't crazy.
What needs to happen next, then? Research first and then policy? Or can they go forward?
I don't believe, I'm a science-based person. I believe that we have to have research. So right now, as I said, there's research going on at all of these institutions on the effects of psychedelic drugs on depression and anxiety. There's amazing, fascinating, exciting research going on about the effects of psychedelic drugs on reducing addiction, specifically to cigarettes, nicotine, but also to opioids like heroin. So LSD and other psychedelics are non-addictive. They don't cause the same kind of harms that heroin does. They don't interfere with day-to-day functioning, and they don't have to be taken forever. So, for example, in the 80s, there was a study on a psychedelic called Ibogaine that found that four treatments with Ibogaine caused people to stop using heroin for up to 3 years. That's remarkable.
It is
indeed. I mean, we have a heroin epidemic now. People are dying in the streets. Kids are dying. And we need to be creative about how we combat this epidemic. And if we can use psilocybin, LSD, Ibogaine as a treatment for heroin addiction, we need to do that now before our body count gets even more horrible.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is Ayelet Waldman. Her book is called A Really Good Day, and it's largely about an experiment with microdosing LSD to treat a very severe mood disorder. And Ayelet, the first thing I ever read that you wrote, you know what I'm going to say, was this essay.
I do.
And it was an essay.
Why is he so controversial, you're thinking?
No, the moment I read the essay, and for those of you who don't know, Ayelet is married to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon, who has been on the show before when he came through South Dakota, and she had written this essay about essentially if you say you love your kids more than you love your spouse, then that makes you a bad mother.
What I was saying was if a good mother is a mother there who loves her children more than her husband, well then I'm a bad mother because I love my husband more than my children.
And I read that essay.
What was your response?
I thought now she's important. I read the essay, and the first thing I thought was, here, I thought of you, and I thought, now, this is an important conversation to have. Is that kind of how it impacted you, that all of a sudden you were launched into a different level of conversation as a writer than you had been before?
Yeah. I mean, you know, before that I had written a lot of murder mysteries and then, you know, a couple of novels, and suddenly I found myself kind of at the center of a storm. I didn't expect it to be quite so intense. Yeah. But you know what was really comforting? I got a lot of email back then from priests, from rabbis, from pastors, basically saying amen, saying, you know, the Bible does not say cleave unto your toddler. The Bible says cleave unto your spouse. And the reason it says that is because that's how you maintain a family. You know, the relationship at the heart of a family is the parental relationship. And when two people love each other and create a family, that relationship has to stay strong for the family to stay strong. And it doesn't do your children any favor if you focus on them so much that you lose the relationship that began the family to begin with. And I think, you know, even as the mommies of the world were yelling at me when I would get an email from a pastor who would say, you know, I don't agree with you on gay marriage. I don't agree with you on a lot of things, but I really agree with you on that. Well, that was really comforting.
Do you think this book, A Really Good Day, is also important in that same sense that it's going to start a really big, diverse conversation in this nation?
I hope so. I mean, here's the thing. There are so many people in pain. We have millions and millions of people in this country taking antidepressants because they are suffering. And we need to have a conversation about this suffering, and we need to start talking about how we can solve this crisis. You know what's really interesting to me? At my events, people will come up very loudly and proudly and say, hey, I used LSD back in the 1960s, or I'm microdose right now. Then people come up to me and they whisper in my ear, I have a mental illness. I have depression. Those people don't feel comfortable speaking out loud. And the fact that we have more of a stigma against being mentally ill, suffering from depression, than we have against using illegal drugs horrifies me. I don't think we have a should have a stigma against either, but I certainly think, you know, diabetics don't feel aren't stigmatized about taking their insulin. People with depression shouldn't feel stigmatized and embarrassed about doing what they need to do to feel better.
You took another risk in this book, and that is to sort of talk about that marriage and say honestly, look, it's not in really good shape right now, largely because this illness that I have is causing a strain. Was that obviously, you know, Michael Chabon, and as a well-known person, you're a well-known person. How'd that feel for you?
It was terrifying. Look, it wasn't, you know, I had been like, I didn't have just a good marriage. I had like a publicly good marriage.
Right.
I had a famously good marriage. And here I was saying, my marriage is in crisis. You know, Michael will tell you that the fact that I believe that our marriage was in crisis is a symptom of my mental illness.
Oh.
That in fact, he wasn't going anywhere. But I felt like, I felt so unlovable. I felt so awful that I couldn't imagine why he could ever love me. I couldn't believe that he did love me. I felt like the least lovable person in the world, and I think that's a really common feature of depression. And, I was thinking a lot about Carrie Fisher recently, who just died. Mm-hmm. When I read Carrie Fisher's writing about being bipolar and the interviews she gave, and she was so forthright and so honest about her bipolar disorder, it was really, as a person with a mood disorder, it was really inspiring and comforting. And I realized that, you know, those of us who are in the public eye, to whatever extent, have an obligation to give that comfort. You know, if my being open about my challenges makes someone else feel less alone, well, you know, then I have to do this. I'm very privileged. You know, I'm a middle-class white woman living in California. A young African-American in Detroit, you know, a young man who is in the same kind of pain. Well, if he took the risk I took, he could end up in jail, much more likely than I could end up in jail. So, you know, as Spider-Man says, with great power comes great responsibility. With great privilege comes great responsibility. And I felt like I had to speak out for people who couldn't speak out and are too, for whom speaking out is too big a risk.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing.
Ayelet Waldman is the author of 5 novels and the essay collection Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace. She joined us in January at the launch of her new book called A Really Good Day. Now, during our second hour, SDPB's Keely Bultina brings you an update on mental health crisis response teams in the state of South Dakota. Stick around for that. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Heath Johnson joins us this Friday for Moment in Sound. Tune in every Friday for live music, poetry, and an arts update. Heath is a Spearfish-based country music singer, songwriter, and performer. As a taste of what you'll hear Friday live, here is a song from early in Heath's career, recorded in his home studio. This one is called Stuck in South Dakota.
Loaded up that U-Haul, sermon for the road. Headed north and headed west till that day was no more. Pulled into the driveway, I don't remember when. Thoughts I had on the open road just circling through my head. Two kids that I love so much, you try to take from me. No church left in this town will ever let me preach. The day I found out you left, well, I hit the floor. To this day, I still feel where my soul is sore. Now I'm stuck in South Dakota with my dreams hung out to dry. Living out these days as they slowly pass me by. I could sit and think of all the things I'll never get to do. But getting stuck in South Dakota, well, that's how I found you. Mistakes I've made just to get to you. Thousands of apologies until my life is through. Shining like an angel right from the sky. Everything I went through, now I finally know why. Why I'm stuck in South Dakota with my dreams hung out to dry. Living out these days as they slowly pass me by. I could sit and think of all the things I'll never get to do. But getting stuck in South Dakota, well, that's how I found you. These days as they slowly pass me by. I could sit and think of all the things I'll never get to do. But getting stuck in South Dakota, well, that's how I found you. Now I'm stuck in South Dakota, living out my dreams with you.
Spearfish-based musician Heath Johnson with Stuck in South Dakota. Tune in Friday for our weekly Moment in Sound with live music from Heath from the South Dakota Public Broadcasting Studios in Rapid City. Now let's keep the conversation about music going, this time with music from around the world. Heather Kuhlman is executive director of the Brookings Arts Council. They have an intriguing residency in the city coming up. She joins us now on the line from Brookings with more. Heather Kuhlman, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you guys giving us a call.
So tell me, let's start talking first about Arts Midwest World Fest and sort of the history of the event, because I understand this is sort of the wrap-up of it. So how did it get started, and who have you had so far?
Thank you. Arts Midwest World Fest is an organization that their mission is to bring musicians to parts of the country in the Midwest that wouldn't normally see these types of ensembles. So when a city is chosen, they're designated as the only city for that state. So this time around, Brookings has been the beneficiary of that hosting situation. We have had a two-year contract with Arts Midwest World Fest, and we've been able to have an ensemble from Israel, Balladino, Le Bande du Noir from Quebec, Canada, Lorraine Clausen from South Africa, and now Anda Union from Inner Mongolia, China.
All right. So tell me the impact of that over the past 2 years has to be fairly remarkable. Talk to me about sort of the early stages of it. And, you know, did people have doubts or anticipation and excitement? And then how did it develop?
Well, Brookings was able to have Arts Midwest about 10 years ago. It was held primarily on SDSU's campus. So we were thrilled when we were approached asking if we would be willing to be hosts again. At the beginning, I have to be honest, we had some huge trepidation. Mm. You know, when you're bringing in an international act that, you know, their music doesn't sound like our music, and sometimes they don't speak our language, and will their music and their culture resonate and translate to our community? You know, plus the offset of expenses had us all equally concerned. But I'm glad to say that it's been nothing short of fantastic and amazing. And with each ensemble, it just has grown. We started out with the Brookings School District and, you know, being around the city of Brookings. And then our last ensemble was Lorraine Clausen. And the White School District asked if they could be a part. And so we were thrilled to be able to start doing a little more outreach with some of the surrounding communities. So it just keeps growing. It's been fantastic. And, you know, this week is bittersweet for us. As we know, this is the conclusion of our contract. But what a way to go out. What a way to go.
So tell me about Anda Union from China.
They are from Inner Mongolia, China. It is a 9-member ensemble. They play strings primarily and flute. And the flute isn't like our American flute that you would hold horizontally. It's a vertical flute. And the individual whose name I will never be able to pronounce, so I'm just going to forgo that. The gentleman that plays that also does throat singing while he plays that.
Oh, wow.
And throat singing is really an interesting technique. To me, it kind of sounds a little bit like bullfrogs. It's that deep, throaty sound. And the way it's been described is that when you sing opera, you open up the throat. Well, with throat singing, you actually contract the throat. Hmm. And when they throat sing, they're able to do two notes at the same time, a low and a high. And the high is accomplished by pressing their tongue to the roof of their mouth behind their front teeth, and then it creates almost a whistling high sound. So at times it sounds sort of bagpipe-ish in the resonance. But it's amazing. And three of the members of the ensemble are able to throat sing. And then they also play what they call a horse head fiddle, which has a very interesting history. So it's been amazing. We've been in the school district so far, and 3M, which is one of the national sponsors as well as one of our local sponsors.
So the flute, the sort of vertical flute, is that akin to the Native American flutes that we see in South Dakota? Is there a connection there?
You know, I think their music has a lot of similarity to the Native culture here. In the music itself, because there's obviously a drum, and it sounds a little bit like our Native American powwow drums. The flute has that sound as well. And the female singer, the way our Native American female singers sing is similar. Also, it seems like the respective culture for nature, heaven and earth combination, is similar also. So it's really kind of cool. And then their love of horses, you know. So you come out to our area of the country, and it's like, yeah, we're all into horses too.
We have more in common than we have not in common, I suppose. What is a horse head fiddle? Can you tell me?
Yeah, I will not do it as well as Tim, their road manager interpreter, but I'll do my best. Evidently, the story goes, or legend has it, that an individual had a white foal, And this foal grew into an amazing horse. And an evil king, as all stories seem to have, an evil king decided he wanted that horse. And so he sent warriors to chase, I think it's Singhi, and capture him and take the horse. And in this, when he was captured, the horse was killed. And so he was devastated. And so the legend goes that the horse came to him in a dream and said, if you take my skin and my bones and create a fiddle using my hair as the strings, every time you play me, I will be with you.
Wow.
And so it's kind of a cool
folk
legend.
Tale, yes. Mm-hmm.
And their fiddles are not fiddles that you would have, like we have a violin off onto a shoulder. It's actually a stringed instrument that only has two strings, but each string comprises of 200 strings.
Sure. Wow.
And it's a vertical.
Huh.
So it's, and each fiddle head, or horse head fiddle, the top of the fiddle is literally a carved horse, and some have the mane. It's amazing.
Tell me how the residency itself and their time. We're talking, if you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment, we're talking to Heather Kuhlman. She's the executive director of the Brookings Arts Council, and we're talking about the final residency in the Arts Midwest World Fest, and this is Anda Union from Inner Mongolia, China. So, Heather, tell me how Anda Union is going to come and interact with the public. What's the residency going to be like for a week?
Well, we started out on Monday at 3 a.m. performing for the employees during their break. And then we had an open house welcome reception to Brookings, introducing them to Brookings at the Children's Museum of South Dakota that was very well attended. And then yesterday we were at Brookings High School performing for second graders in the morning, the high school in the afternoon. Today we have been at Camelot for the fourth and fifth graders, and then we're off to the middle school this afternoon. Wednesday, or today is Wednesday. I'm lost already.
Right?
Thursday, we will be at the South Dakota Art Museum at 10 a.m. for a free workshop. And then we're off to White School District. And then I think a newly added something is we're trying to get down to the Flandreau Indian School Friday morning so that the two cultures can meet each other and discuss the similarities that you and I were just discussing. And then the concert is our only ticketed event, and that is Friday evening at Bell Auditorium, which is at the high school. Doors open at 6:30. Concert starts at 7:30. Advance tickets can be purchased in Brookings at Artworks or online on our website at www.brookingsartscouncil.org. Advance tickets are considerably less expensive than the day of the event. Seniors and students, tickets are $7, adults are $12 in advance, but Friday night at the door, all tickets will be $15. So we encourage everyone to get their tickets ahead of time.
Heather,
and then Saturday, they'll wander, and they'll get to explore all the great things around.
Oh, wow. What's some of the reaction been from, you know, second graders to high schoolers? What have you seen from kids who experience Anda Union in Brookings now?
Well, you know, it's always interesting, because that's a good question as far as age range. You know, the littles are a lot more excited and less inhibited when it comes to trying to learn the language or perform a cultural dance than high schoolers. Mm-hmm. But I will say yesterday's high schoolers, we had a full stage. So
right.
They were into it. And one of the fourth graders today was asked, what did you like about Anda Union? And his response was, there aren't enough adjectives.
Oh, well. That's high praise indeed right there.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking about the work that they do in Inner Mongolia for, you know, some of those kids of the same age in their home country to sort of, you know, carry on the traditions of this music. Do you know anything about that?
You know, I know that Anda Union has said at different times, or Tim has said at different times, that, you know, the traditional folk songs, which is what Anda Union performs, is a dying music. It is a dying language. And so their hope and mission in being together for 16 years and performing is to keep it alive. The Inner Mongolian people are traditionally nomads. And so these are the stories of the people as they travel.
So you have the folk tales, you have the folk music, and then you have the language. How is that language surviving in Mongolia?
You know, that I haven't heard.
Right. It's just a curiosity. You see a lot of similarities, don't you?
You do. And what I didn't realize is that Inner Mongolia is not Mongolia. It's its own separate province.
Well, I didn't know that. Thank you for clearing that up. Huh.
Yeah, and I did not know that either. And, you know, it's bordered by a number of things. So their language, the members of the ensemble speak a number of languages, Russian, Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, Mongolese, I think is how they pronounced it.
What's your experience been like interacting with this troupe of artists this week?
Oh,
for you personally.
You know, there's a language barrier.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think you always have to understand each other's words, because faces say a lot and eyes dance and gestures and people just read people. And so it's been fun. I have to say that, you know, having experienced all four ensembles, this has been a highlight of my career with the Brookings Arts Council, and I feel quite confident that the impact Arts Midwest has had on Brookings will not be soon forgotten.
Mm. If you have to close it out with a lot of strength and something wonderful as you wrap things up. Heather Kuhlman, one more time, the workshop and the things that are open to the public, the Friday night concert at 6:30. We got about 30 seconds left. Can you give us those details one more time in case people want to see Anda Union in Brookings?
Sure. We would invite everyone to join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the South Dakota Art Museum, a beautiful venue to attend, and that's free. And then the concert Friday evening at Bell Auditorium, which is at Brookings High School. Ticket sales and doors open at 6:30. The show begins at 7:30. And advance tickets can be purchased at the BrookingsArtsCouncil.org website or Artworks on Main Street of Brookings. We encourage you to buy in advance. You save some money. All tickets the evening of the concert will be $15. And we encourage everyone to come. Don't miss it.
All right. Heather Kuhlman is Executive Director of the Brookings Arts Council. Heather, thank you so much for sharing with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us. Have a great day.